This is a podcast from Minute Media.
Hello, and welcome to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason, and with me as usual is Rich. Hello, Rich.
Hey, what's going on?
You know, not a whole lot. We take a little break after episode 300, been watching these NBA playoffs, you know, enjoying life, doing our thing, but time to get cracking on another podcast.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was an unintentional delay where we didn't quite realize that we had been gone so long. We're like, oh, crap, we better do a show sometime soon. So, yeah, we're here. We're back. Yeah, there you go.
Right?
So, yeah, it is not over. 300 was not the last episode ever.
No, not
301 could be. Who knows?
You
never know what's going to happen. But
the future's not promised.
Yeah. But for now, 301, and we'll continue to move on as we 400. We can get to 400, right?
We can get to 400.
500. I'm not promising 500.
Right,
that might be
that's
hard.
Fair. That's fair.
We'll
fair.
See what happens. Who knows? Yeah, it's great.
We're getting old, so you know it's tough. Yeah. So. Yeah, speaking of the future not being promised, we have a excellent show today. Teams that added a big star but severely underperformed. Found a lot of interesting stories here. You know, two examples this year. One being the Nets. You know, they were swept in the first round after they gained and lost James Harden. Kind of were expected to get Ben Simmons to replace him, but that never really happened, at least not this year. And then also the Lakers winning only 33 games after adding Russell Westbrook. I think both teams coming into the season, there was at least somewhat expectations, you know, if not a championship, certainly deep playoff run. I mean, you know, the Lakers, there are probably some warning signs with Westbrook, but I don't think anyone thought they were going to win 33 games. Like, I think they at least were going to be like a solid playoff team. So
Yeah. I remember discussing the Lakers in the offseason with my buddies, and I had a few bets, actually. My friends were like, oh, I think they're going to win the championship. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to bet that they're not going to win the championship. That was our bet, though. It was just like the championship or not. Not like, I think they're really going to win. I mean, nobody was like, I wonder if this team's going to struggle to even be 500. It was like, nobody. Right. I mean, yeah, you thought, okay, yeah, is this a championship core? Maybe not, but it still has LeBron. It still has Anthony Davis. And, you know, maybe you get something out of what. Yeah, I don't think anybody expected 33 games for the Lakers. So, yeah, I did cash in on those championship or no championship bets for my friends. But, yeah, they paid me in, like, you know, with 2 months left in the season was an unforeseen result of what the whole season was.
Sure. Absolutely. Yes. So we're talking about a handful of teams here. We are not going to count the 2004 Lakers. Hey, they were the number two seed. They made the finals. You know,
right. Really I see good. Them. Yeah. I see them a lot in these lists, and that team was like very close to winning a championship. Yes, they all wanted to punch each other, but like that's happened before too. Title teams have done that. Like, was that team long for the world? No, but they very likely could have if they just decided that they didn't want to like really punch each other in the finals. Like, they probably could have won. Or if Malone doesn't get hurt, there's a good chance, you know, not taking anything away from that Pistons team that was great, but they don't belong in this list at all. They don't belong in any list of like disappointing teams because they were really good and they almost won the titles. So they just all hated each other and wanted to hit each other. So
I think we have we're trying to get true disappointments here.
Yes.
Like, the hype was high. You know, there was expected to, you know, be a championship team or at least, you know, be up there, and they really severely underperformed. So hopefully listeners, hey, you agree, you don't agree, let us know.
We
always enjoy.
Maybe
missed team. Maybe we're stretching here. There's one team here, which honestly I think is a little bit of a stretch, but I think it's an interesting story, and that's what we're all about. So should be a good time.
Is that what we do? Interesting stories? Yeah.
All right. I believe so, yes.
I guess we try that. Yeah, we try.
Right. I mean,
no, I'm just kidding.
Sometimes we tell boring stories, but hopefully in an interesting way.
But you learn. Yeah, you learn from the boring stories. Hopefully.
You learn. So. Sometimes you do, yes. Yes, boredom can be a great motivator. So we're going to start off with, why not start off 1971 Atlanta Hawks. Yeah, my Atlanta Hawks, wonderful. This is their third year in Atlanta. They've been a solid team for the last couple of years. They made two straight division finals. This is before conference. So basically they were one step away from the NBA finals. You know, they had Lou Hudson, you know, excellent scorer. They had Bill Bridges, great rebounder. They had Walt Bellamy's, you know, one of the better centers of his league, of his time. Walt Hazard was a good guard. You know, they were a really solid team. You know, kept bumping into the Lakers in the division finals. But, hey, they were really good. Then they add Pete Maravich, you know, one of the most hyped college stars ever. Averaged 44 points per game in his career at LSU. You know, a flashy play, you know, awesome highlight reel passes, you know, a guy who's absolutely, you know, is he a great player? It's questionable. Is he a star? Absolutely. He is a star, you know, gets a lot of people really excited, especially white people, you know,
and that's a great white hope. Yeah. The one, yeah, the, great one white of the hope, first right? great white hopes of, you know, yeah, it's not, the league hasn't been, you know, quote unquote, black for a lot of years, but they were still way, oh my God, okay, we've had Russell, we've had Will, we've had all these, okay, we need to get another guy, we need to get another, and Maravich was that guy. I mean, I think not even with like hushed tones, like straight up like considered, oh, thank God we finally have a white superstar again in the league. So yeah, it was definitely that.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yes. And yeah, and the Hawks were very much, you know, their dominant players were all African-American players. So yeah, they were very much a black team. You know, there was, as we'll get into, there's a lot of there was a lot of focus on that during the time that they were there. So yeah, you know, they've got Coach Richie Guerin. You know, they've got pretty much, they bring everybody back from the prior year, adding Maravich. Their only major loss was two-time All-Star Joe Caldwell, who went to the ABA. He wasn't like a huge star, but he was definitely a good player and an important to the team. And you know, and they ended up missing him quite a bit, it turns out. So. But you think, yeah, adding a budding superstar to a team with a bunch of, like, you know, really good players, but no real star, seems like a decent bet. That's, you know, that's worked in the past and has worked, would work in the NBA in the future. But for this team, not so much.
No.
They go from 48 wins to 36 wins. They do make the playoffs, but only like in really screwy circumstances, which we'll get into. But they made each other miserable, though. Like, they were kind of doing that even before Pistol joined the squad. So, you know, they were a bit of a cantankerous bunch, so that part of it, I mean, definitely that dynamic added to it, but they already were a little bit like that. They made the playoffs. It was, so this was the first year of conferences, you know, there were two divisions, now there were two conferences with four divisions, and each division, you know, you had two teams that were going to make it, regardless, you know, the top two teams in each division. So the Hawks make it, they win 36 games. The Celtics, who finished third in their division, don't make it. They win 44 games. So that's obviously, you know, pretty scurry. The West is even worse.
I was going to say the West is even more galling. That the Phoenix Suns win 48 games and don't make it. But the 41-41 San Francisco Warriors do make it. So, yeah, brutal stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
The Pistons are 45 wins in the Midwest. The entire Midwest division has more than 45 wins, but they can only have two representatives, and they have the Bucks, who are very, very good. They have Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and the Bulls, who have a very good year at 51 and 31. And, yeah, the Suns at 48 wins out of the playoffs, the Pistons at 45 wins out of the playoffs. And yet you have the 36-win Atlanta Hawks over here in the East and the 41-win Pacific Division representative San Francisco Warriors making it. So yeah, rough playoff format here. I get what they were going for, but you could pretty much see from day one, oh crap, this isn't gonna work. But
yeah, they ended up I think that they had like 2 or 3 years of this format before they went to like a more normal playoff format. So of at least the top team had to make it, but like, you know, they would choose the, otherwise they would just be like the, you know, They didn't end up screwing teams over that much. After this was the by far the worst year of that.
Right. This is when they really tried to make these divisions matter, and we see that now. I mean, they don't matter at all. Like, they pretty much, especially in today's NBA, matter like almost none whatsoever. Divisions, other than, you know, who you play a little bit, but even that, I wonder if in the next few years we're going to see that kind of melt away a bit, as because like MLB is doing that. I think next year they're starting where everyone's doing balanced schedule. So it literally does not matter where you play, what division you play in, anything like that. And I do wonder if the NBA starts, it gets kind of close to that pretty soon as well. But yeah, this year they really wanted to make divisions matter. A couple years later, they're going to make conferences matter more. And then everyone's kind of wondering when eventually they might just let all of that go. But I don't know. We've had shows about that, kind of playoff changes and playoff format changes and whatnot. But I don't know. I enjoy the conferences at least a little bit, but I do not enjoy divisions because who cares?
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. The Midwest, the Western, I do always love the Western Conference Midwest division though, which is Detroit. When I think Western America, I think of Detroit, Michigan.
Well, sure, so. I mean, I guess the Bucks and the Bulls and the Pistons kind of fit together in a division. The Suns, definitely not.
Yeah, that's a rough travel. It didn't affect the Pistons. They were still pretty good. But yeah, rough travel to have to go to Phoenix as often as they had to go to Phoenix. But
right, yeah.
But so, yeah, I mean, that's, when you have a team in Cincinnati and a team in Buffalo and a team in Baltimore, I mean, you're going to have to, that's a lot of East Coast. So
And hey, the Baltimore and Atlanta were stuck in the West for quite a while.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so yeah,
Atlanta.
Everybody got screwed over by that. So yes. So yeah. So expectations for the Hawks, you know, they are definitely they're high, but hey, things kind of go sour quickly. An excellent article from the time from Sport Magazine, which is brought to us by from waydowntown.com. Yeah, basically, it's kind of just talking about the teams. Like, hey, the thought is, you know, Maravich, if he can make the adjustment to the pros quickly, they absolutely, you know, this team could be a dynasty. I mean, they're so, you know, well balanced. You know, they got, you know, Lou Hudson's one of the best shooters. You know, they Walt Bellamy and Bill Bridges, excellent rebounders, and Walt Hazard and Joe Caldwell, just great playmakers before, you know, Caldwell absolutely leaves. You know, see, advanced season ticket sales double, so there's excitement. You know, they're fairly new to Atlanta, and Atlanta's, you know, a growing, thriving state. It's like, yeah, pro basketball can take its place in Atlanta. You know, opening games scheduled for network television, but training camp happens, and things get a little weird. Bill Bridges, he was fired as team captain and reinstated only hours later. Joe Caldwell has a holdout eventually, and, you know, he wants more money. He eventually goes to the ABA, you know, just like Zemo Beatty had the previous year, you know, one of their best centers. So the Hawks have a history of not paying their guys very much, except for Maravich, of course. You know, Lou Hudson has an injury, you know, Hazard just, you know, kind of struggles there a little bit. You know, obviously Maravich is playing his position. You know, maybe there's a little bit, you know, of nerves for there. And you know, 2 months into the season, the Hawks had the fourth worst record in the league. Only the three expansion teams had worst records. Yeah. So, you know, they struggle. Definitely, you know, there's some bitterness among the team at the attention that Maravich gets. It's kind of a mix because, you know, I think they all sort of understand the situation. They resent it a little bit. Some of them resent him a little bit. You know, the Hawks president, Bob Cousins, says, like, oh, maybe we overdid the advanced billing on Maravich. You know, maybe if I'd had more experience in basketball, we could avoid some of the problems that we've had. You know, there's a Sports Illustrated article toward the end of that season. They do end up sort of rallying. They do make the playoffs, as we mentioned, with 36 wins. You know, their record is at least not fourth worst in the league at that point. You know, but everyone says this is a really grueling season. It's really hard. Everyone says, like, it's pretty bad. Well, Hazard says, hey, when things are going bad, the whole air is bad. It becomes even hard to live together. You know, and you know, Maravich does things that's, you know, outlined here. And also there's a great book on I've got Pistol on Maravich that I recommend everybody read.
Really,
but
good stuff.
Yeah, and Maravich does stuff like, you know, like picks up the check for his teammates. It's like, okay, I'm making so much more money, I need to pick up the check for my teammates. But then, like, some of his teammates kind of resent that. It's like, you know, like, oh, he's like, is he trying to, like, show us up, or is he trying to,
he's
like,
also,
yeah,
23 years old here, you know what I mean? So sure. It's like, yeah, you got this 23-year-old superstar that's making more money than all these veterans. That's tough to live with that. It's there's a psychological thing that, you know, sometimes it works. You know, sometimes if you have the right guy and the right star and the right team and all that sort of stuff, it works. But yeah, in this case, like you said, it was already kind of a cantankerous bunch, and now they're all scrapping together, you know, whatever money they can make in the NBA as professional basketball players. And then this, you know, white superstar comes in, he's getting all the hype, he's getting all the money, and yeah, it wasn't the right crew, he probably wasn't the right guy, and it just, yeah, I totally see how, yeah, him coming in and saying, don't worry guys, I'll pick up the bill, is like, all right, dude, get out of here. You know, it's tough. It, there's a psychological thing for sure there that you could totally see. From, you know, the standpoint of, hell, if it happened in your job, you might do the same thing. If some, you know, hotshot 22-year-old executive comes in and is like, hey, I'm buying lunch for everybody. You're like, oh, screw this guy. Like, you know, it's kind of, yeah, I totally get it.
Right. And as we know now, Maravich was like an extremely weird combination of, like, psychologically tormented, but also, like, extremely pampered and catered to.
Yes.
Like,
right,
you know,
right, right.
So that was a real, you know, psychological thing. And yeah, there's just the natural, like, adjusting to the NBA as, like, you know, a lead guard, and how, you know, there's some guys made that adjustment right away. Obviously Oscar Robertson was awesome right away, but, you know, even somebody like Jerry West and, or, you know, Walt Frazier, who, you know, became among the best players in the game. You know, they early in the career took them a couple years or so to really figure out and actually be, like, you know, a star player. So yeah, and then there's a great Dick Motta quote describing Pete Maravich's defense is bearing considerable resemblance to the Lend-Lease program. So it's because you don't get enough Lend-Lease.
A very 70s joke
references.
Right there. I love
yeah,
it.
Yeah, right. Yes,
that is the
yeah.
most Dick Motta 1971 quote ever. I love it.
Exactly. So
the Lend-Lease program.
The Lend-Lease program. Hey, you can bring a 40s reference into a you know, to a 70s joke. It's a good time. But that's the dad joke of the time. You know, that's
oh,
like
God.
That's like me trying to make, you know, jokes to my daughter about like 80s music. You know?
Yeah,
like,
right,
yeah,
right, right.
Yeah. It's like
Lend-Lease program.
Yeah, Lend-Lease program. Anyway, so and you know, so I mean, indefinitely, he really he had a tough time with the expectations. You know, he's dubbed the Miracle Man, as we said. You know, he struggled early, and then like suddenly he's getting booed by the team. He's taking, you know, gets a lot of pressure. You know, the news media, the fans, everything. You know, he says, well, like, yeah, because when somebody signs this type of contract, you're automatically going to have resentment because it's part of human nature. It's something you have to adjust to, too. There's nothing you can really do about it. You try to earn respect and maybe have them accept you as what you are. But, you know, definitely will felt that pressure immediately right away and struggled with it to an extent. Yeah, I mean, now, you know, to give it a little bit of context, like he was still like, I mean, he statistically he was one of the better guards in the league still.
Yeah.
Like he
was,
he certainly wasn't like a bad player by any stretch, but you know, and there's always kind of been, but he averaged like, you know, 23 points per game that season. You know, I think he was second in Rookie of the Year, but I don't think he won Rookie of the Year, but he was second in Rookie of the Year. But I mean, he still was statistically a you know, performed well in a lot of ways. But you know, made the all rookie team, obviously. So it wasn't like he was a complete disaster, but you know, in terms of like matching the hype, it was going to be extremely difficult to do that. End of the season, yeah, they ended up losing to the defending champion Knicks in the first round 4-1. Maravich had 22 points per game, although only 4-12 true shooting, which was bad even then. 5.2 rebounds, 4.8 assists. Interestingly enough, but it just kind of shows you the difference in the league from now to then. The Hawks literally play they play seven guys, but Jerry Chambers, their seventh guy, plays 22 minutes in four games during the series. So really they play six guys in the series. And now the, you know, the Knicks play, you know, they play 10 guys, but like, you know, it just how heavily they relied on like their top five or six guys at this point. And, you know, there's still most teams now, you know, have an eight-man rotation, but the minutes certainly are balanced more than now than they are then. It's just, it's interesting to look at.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's total. Well, what you're trying to say is today's players are weak. And
I am.
And,
they
yeah,
are weak.
They're weak.
They
they're pampered.
Cowards.
They're babies, yeah. Millennials.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
The Lend-Lease program for all of them. You know what I mean? They
right.
all just want freebies. They all want handouts.
They all just want the Lend-Lease program. Absolutely. That's all the kids care
that's what
about.
You've been trying to do. So you're trying to tell your daughter, you know, don't become one of
right.
those, you know, Lend-Lease program people.
Right. Yes.
She's like, what are you talking
yeah.
about?
Yeah. Earn your lease. Yeah.
Yes, right.
Don't expect it to be lended to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's like, well, go away. Yes, I will go away. Yes. Speaking of going away, I guess the 1999 Houston Rockets.
Oh, yeah. They went away.
So they went away very quickly. For the purposes of this, and what's unfortunate is this team sometimes does get lumped into like this whole Rockets era. The 1997 Rockets were good as hell. They added Charles Barkley. They already had Clyde Drexler and Hakeem Olajuwon. That team was solid, though. They won 57 games. They made it to the Western Conference Finals. They were a John Stockton, like, miracle three away from maybe making the NBA Finals. Like, we're not counting them. You know, we're not. That right. team is really, really good. They did not disappoint. They were fine. The 1989 Rockets, oh, yeah, they disappointed. They added Scottie Pippen.
Yeah.
And this deal was not finalized until January due to the NBA lockout. But was a huge move for both the Bulls and the Rockets. It first for the Bulls signified that this competitive window was officially done. And everybody knew that it was done. But yeah, after Michael Jordan and Phil Jackson are done and Michael Jordan retires for the second time, Phil Jackson retires for the first of many times. This was the final nail in the coffin that this thing is done. This thing is over. And, you know, much had been made about Pippen and his contract with the Bulls, and it was a big part of the Last Dance documentary and stuff, and how he was, you know, woefully underpaid for many years. And regardless of your thoughts on that and whatnot, Chicago and GM Jerry Krause, I think, did a pretty solid thing for Pippen at the end of here, doing a sign-and-trade as opposed to simply letting Pippen leave for free agency, because by doing the sign-and-trade, they were able to give him a much bigger deal, 5 years, $67.2 million, with $15 million in incentives as well, thanks to bird rights and some other wrinkles in signing your own players. Now, how much credit do we want to give them for saying, hey, we'll pay you, but by pay you, I mean another team will pay you. We'll just right. do that. Like, yeah. I guess they could have just said, fuck you, go away. But at least they made it so the Houston Rockets had to pay him more money. So whatever you want to give credit to, at least they did that, and at least Pippen was able to make a little bit more money. And the Bulls, in exchange, got quite literally not. They got Roy Rogers and a second-round pick. So they pretty much said, we're good. We just take this guy. We just want to be really, really bad. And it worked out very well. They were really, really bad for a lot of years. Pippen would say, I would like to thank the Chicago Bulls, the great people of the city of Chicago, and all of my teammates for 11 wonderful seasons. I'd also like to personally thank the Bulls for helping me through this period of free agency. I wish them the best because that is what Chicago deserves. So there you go. So anyway, to bring Pippen into the fold here, the Rockets asked Charles Barkley, a free agent at that time, hey, we still want to bring you, we still want to keep you, but would you mind taking a little bit of a pay cut? So Charles Barkley has talked about this on numerous shows and numerous things, including Bill Simmons's Any Given Wednesday show. He says, quote, the only year that I was fat, I don't know the context of like what question was asked, but probably like, hey, what do you make of people saying that you got fat? Because Pippen would always say, oh, his fat butt. He would always refer to Barkley as fat butt or whatever.
Yeah.
This didn't go well, in case you're wondering.
No,
spoiler, it doesn't go well. Considering one of the players calls the other guy fat butt all the time. So he says, the only year that I was fat was my last year in Houston because they had promised me $12 million. When I showed up, the contract was only for $8 million. And I said, what happened to my other $4 million? And they said, well, we've just decided to keep it. So what happened here is that Barkley and the Rockets had agreed to a $12 million deal, but that was before the lockout, so they couldn't really do anything. Well, the Rockets said that they were kind of spooked, and I think all teams were kind of spooked by the recent Minnesota Timberwolves, Joe Smith, kerfuffle, whatever you want to bring, you know, so they didn't want to put anything in writing yet, especially not during the lockout, especially not under the table deals, anything like that. So there was nothing in writing. It was just kind of a verbal, hey, yeah, we'll give you $12 million. Okay, when the lockout's over, we'll get back and we'll put pen to paper there. So when the lockout's over and Barkley goes, okay, I'd like my $12 million, they then said, well, now we have Scottie Pippen, so would you mind taking less? Barkley eventually says, sure, I guess. It's going to get a Scottie Pippen. We're hopefully going to win a championship. It's one of my final few years in the league. That's fine. So there were some issues getting the contract all the way ironed out for Scottie Pippen, but finally, on January 23rd, 1999, it is official. Scottie Pippen says, I'll have no problem putting on this jersey. I'm very comfortable with it. In fact, I'm going to sleep in it tonight. So those jerseys suck, so I hope he doesn't sleep in them. So.
Right. Had he ever seen those jerseys? I mean, I would have... Like,
I would be caught dead sleeping or living in that in those stink-ass jerseys. So God. But anyway, this new Rockets team seemed doomed pretty much from the start. So Barkley not getting the money he thought he deserved because they bring in Scottie Pippen. Plus, it was going to be a weird season no matter what. The lockout had caused a very unique and different than usual schedule for the NBA. One that in aging and, what's the best terminology here for Charles Barkley at this time? Portly fella, Charles. Yeah. He was certainly...
Husky. Husky. Yes.
He wasn't 1993 Phoenix Suns Charles. But when you think... it's always hilarious when you go back and watch like 80s Barkley and that was his nickname was like the round mound of rebound or whatever. And you're like, that guy's in like tremendous shape. Like, sure, he ate, you know, not great, but look at him. He's still like... And then you see like this Barkley, you're like, oh, I get it for this Barkley. You know, especially post-lockout where Barkley was not the only player to that pretty much assumed the lockout was never going to end. And then they said, oh, it's ending. And we're playing in a couple weeks, and they went, ooh. Oops, so about that. I have been eating and not playing basketball, so I'm a little... So he was not great. He says, quote, I can't play three games in three nights. I can tell you that right now. I don't want to have sex three nights in a row. I definitely don't want to play three games in three nights. So... There you go. The money's back again because Charles Barkley also said, I was laying on the trainer's table and Matt Bullard came in and he kicked me off of it. He says that he makes more money than I do, so he has first dibs on the table. What kind of league is this when Matt Bullard makes more money than I do?
That's not a bad question, I guess.
I mean, he's not wrong, but that tells you where we're at with this season, just in case you're wondering where things are going. This is his teammates that he's talking about here. So other changes to the team as well. Clyde Drexler smartly is like, deuces, I'm out. This isn't going to work out very well, so I'm leaving. Antoine Carr, the Utah Jazz NBA Finals legend, is signed and brought in. But otherwise, things stayed pretty consistent from the team that that disappointed last year, going 41-41. They lost in the first round, but things were changing. They were bringing in Scottie Pippen, one of the, you know, one of the great players in the NBA, second, you know, guy, you know, had led to the Bulls or was a big part of the Bulls winning, you know, six titles in 8 years or whatever. So yeah, he's back. He's here. Drexler's gone, but Hakeem is still there. Barkley's still there. Everything is still going to work. They start pretty well. They're 6-2. They lose five of their next six games, and they sputter into the end of the first month at 8-6. They get a hot month of March, including a 9-game win streak. Hey, things are okay. And they go into April 22-9. They end the season at 31-19, third in the competitive NBA Midwest Division. The team finishes 14 in SRS, fifth in offensive rating, unfortunately 15th in defensive rating, not that great. And Charles Barkley, despite it all, plays really, really well. He averages 16.1 points per game, 12.3 rebounds per game in 42 games. He becomes the second player in NBA history after Wilt Chamberlain to accumulate 23,000 points, 12,000 rebounds, and 4,000 assists in his career. Another Wilt stat there, of course. There's always a Wilt stat.
Yeah. Always a Wilt stat, yeah.
Hakeem Olajuwon, another really good season for him. I mean, there's always this idea that he had started to get really old. That was coming in like the Toronto years, but he was still really good here. He plays in all 50 games. He averages 18.9 points per game, 9.6 rebounds per game. And they also get some great contributions from young players like Michael Dickerson, who has 10.9 points per game. I completely forgot about this, that Ketino Mobley was on this team at this time, 9.9 points per game. Othella Harrington, 9.8 points per game. And Michael Dickerson, a renaissance man, shoots 43% from three and takes a lot of threes. He's like, I'm going to take these threes and I'm going to make them. And they're like, okay.
All right, sure.
Is that going to work though? Like, yeah. So what's going to happen though? He's like, well, I'm going to shoot it from this line and that's going to be worth more than two and I'm going to make them more often than not. And they're like, okay.
I mean, right.
if you want to try it, you can try it. But what about Scotty though? I have not mentioned Scotty Pippen in all those names that I mentioned. Well, that's because he plays in all 50 games. That's good. And that surprises a lot of people because he had battled some major back injuries during his last year with the Bulls. He played in only 44 games and pretty much, you know, was a non-factor during some of the NBA Finals games. But despite all that, Pippen averages 19.9 points per game, or 19.1 points per game in 1998, last season with the Bulls, 6.6 win shares. In 1999, though, something just happened. He scores only 14.5 points per game, his lowest since his sophomore year back in 1989. Pippen went from shooting 44.7% from the field in his Finals Bulls season to a career low 43.2% as a Rocket. He did increase his rebounding total, and overall it wasn't a bad season, but he was definitely not the superstar that Houston thought they were getting. He still made the NBA All-Defensive First Team. That was his eighth time doing that. So anyway, the stage is set, Rockets versus Lakers, first round of the playoffs. Lakers, a very emerging team with Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant. They were going through some of their own turmoil as well, as Del Harris is fired and Kurt Rambis takes over for a little bit. We're not quite in the Phil Jackson era yet. That is coming very, very soon. But it's Rockets-Lakers. Barkley plays great in these playoffs. He averages 23.5 points per game, 52.9% shooting, and 13.8 rebounds per game. This is going to, unfortunately, be his final postseason. Olajuwon does struggle a little bit. He has trouble guarding and scoring on peak Shaq. 13.3 points per game and 7.3 rebounds per game. Pippen, he plays well, though. Definitely better than his regular season. He has 18.3 points per game, 11.8 rebounds per game, and 5.5 assists per game. So that's really good. What's not really good is he shoots 32.9% from the field. So not great. On the flip side, Shaq, 29.5 points per game, 10.3 rebounds per game. And both Glenn Rice and Kobe Bryant average 18 a game as well. So Houston loses game one by just one. They lose game two by a pretty healthy margin. They win game three pretty easily. Then they lose game four by 10 to end their hopeful season in a whimper. But that's all right. You can just run this thing back, right? Well, no. No. Because shit hits the fan almost immediately. They're eliminated. Pippen says, I'm out. I want to be traded. I'm done with the Rockets. He wants to join his old Bulls coach, Phil Jackson, who has now joined the Lakers. So a proto Durant over there, you know, saying, hey, I lost to them in the playoffs, but I want to join them because that looks like a lot more fun than whatever we're doing here. And that does not go over well with, one Charles Barkley does not love that. He says, for him to want to leave after 1 year, it disappointed me greatly. The Rockets went out of the way to get Scotty, and the fans have treated him well, so I was just disappointed in him. Pippen, not exactly gracious about this as well. He says, I wouldn't give Charles Barkley an apology at gunpoint. He can never expect an apology from me. If anything, he owes me an apology for coming to play with his fat butt. So there you go. Charles then said, all right, well, that's what we're going to do. He says, quote, I should have listened to Michael Jordan a year ago when he said, oh, sorry, this is Pippen again. One more time. I probably should have listened to Michael Jordan a year ago when he said that Charles will never win a championship because he doesn't show any dedication. He's a very selfish guy. He doesn't show the desire to want to win. That's my reason for wanting to get away from playing with him, because he just doesn't show the dedication. Yikes.
Yikes. Yeah.
So Pippen is traded by the Rockets to the Portland Trail Blazers in October of 1999 on exchange for Stacey Augmon, Kelvin Cato, Ed Gray, Carlos Rogers, Brian Shaw, and Walt Williams, where then he'll join another team that's, we can't call them. I mean, they were, again, like one horrific comeback or a comeback from making the NBA Finals, but another a pretty disappointing team. But don't belong on this list because they were pretty damn good despite all the disappointment. But things didn't go great in Portland either. And then Pippen eventually is, you know, we'll go back to the Bulls and then he'll retire. So
yeah. And I would say, like, regular season, the 99 Rockets, you know, they went from, you know, being a 500 team to a team, you know, in the abbreviated season, they won 31 out of 50 games. So, you know, like, regular season wise, like, yeah, they were definitely better, but they, you know, disappointed, you know, only they lost to the Lakers in the first round. It definitely didn't, you know, meet the hype. So the Matt Ballard and Charles Barkley thing, I dug into that a little bit. So it is true. So Barkley, apparently he made $1 million in the 99 season, but then made $9 million in the 2000 season. So I don't know if they...
Yeah, I think there was some
That actually happened. Yeah.
Yeah, there was... I was trying to figure that out as well. It seems like there was some weird kind of salary cap manipulation thing that they were doing there where, like the contract that we talked about was still, you know, worth whatever amount of money. But like for some reason that year, he only made $1 million because they wanted to, you know, get Pippen in there. It was all done because like they brought in Pippen. They obviously couldn't, like, financially, it didn't quite work. When you're bringing in Scottie Pippen at $50 million or whatever, you know, the 5 year or whatever the hell we said for him, and you're giving, you know, Roy Rogers back, like, something's got to give there in that salary cap thing. It was hard to find exactly what it was, but it was some sort of salary cap manipulation or something going on there where Barkley is technically only making $1 million that year, even though, you know, his contract is worth a little bit more.
Right. And Matt Ballard made $1.3 million, at least according to Basketball Reference. So it wasn't like, technically it was true, but over the life of the contract, Charles was still making more. Right. So it wasn't quite that, you know, that crazy, but
it wasn't a Jim McElvay, Sean Kemp situation.
Sean Kemp.
It's like quite literally making more than me. It's like, what the hell are we doing here? Get out of here.
Right. Exactly. So, that's definitely interesting. I wonder if 6-for-1 is a record in NBA trades. There can't be many more, you know, like, I wonder if there's ever been a 7 guys for 1 a trade in the NBA. I mean, I wouldn't think so, but we'll have to dig into that one, see if that one has ever happened before. Yeah, and you definitely, like, you know, the one guy who I don't think you talked briefly about, but Olajuwon. Like, I mean, Olajuwon was he was still pretty good, but no longer an all-star. But yeah, I mean, Pippen was 33, Barkley was 35, Olajuwon was 36. I mean, at some point, you know, these guys are going to fade, and they didn't have a whole lot of depth. I mean, you know, they had solid years, as you mentioned, from Dickerson, Mobley, Alfell Harrington, but there weren't a lot of guys here who were, you know, really, you know, contributing a whole lot. You know, they had Dale Antoine Carr was 37. They had Eddie Johnson for 3 games, who was 39. You know, they were an old team, and they didn't have a lot of depth, which is, you know, one thing you sacrifice when you bring in Scottie Pippen and you know, trade him for a lot of guys is, they didn't have a whole lot of depth there. And Pippen just wasn't good enough really to, you know, to take them over the top. He was pretty good, but definitely, you know, had fallen short of being a superstar.
Yeah. And just, the cantankerous part of everybody just hating each other.
The
Pippen Barkley thing just did not work from day one. And you do kind of feel bad for Hakeem, who at that time had pretty much mellowed out. Like, you know, Hakeem had his, you know, his ups and downs. But at this point, he's won 2 titles. He's just kind of like, he's probably just like, come on, guys. Like, let's go. Let's just, what are we doing here? But it ended up not working out very well for Houston. I mean, they were able to get back competitive a couple years later. So it wasn't too bad, you know, obviously with Francis and Mobley and then bringing in Yao Ming or whatever. So they'd had some lean years, but, you know, they've for the most part been pretty solid for a couple decades at this point. You know, until the most recent time, where they're not very competitive at all right now. So they're pretty, pretty terrible. But
So next we have, and this is the one that is a bit of a stretch, but hear me out. The 1975 Memphis Sounds. They played in the ABA. So many people, listeners here, may not have heard about the Memphis Sounds or do know very little about the Memphis Sounds. You may recall that the Grizzlies a couple years ago, they busted out the Memphis Sounds uniforms. They're beautiful looking uniforms. So, you know, they were basically an expansion team, you know, with a new name. Again, they'd been the Tams and the Pros previously. They became the Sounds, much better name, great uniforms, as we mentioned. new ownership. You know, they had Charlie Finley as their owner, and that did not, you know, Charlie Finley is a famous owner of the Oakland Athletics, who was known for being extremely cheap and, you know, and not a good steward of a professional sports team. Memphis, it went far worse than it went in Oakland, because at least Oakland won things and Memphis did not. But, you know, Mike Storin, who was the NBA commissioner, or the ABA commissioner, excuse me, and had, you know, led franchises. He led the Pacers, you know, who became a dynasty of the ABA, led the Kentucky Colonels, you know, who were an excellent team as well. Really thought like, hey, Memphis can work here. So they decided, hey, we're going to bring in three of the top four players from the Pacers dynasty. They last won the title in 73. They nearly made the 74 finals. Roger Brown, Mel Daniels, and Freddie Lewis. And this is the best comparison I can kind of think of, is basically like, imagine, you know, the Orlando Magic getting Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, and Andre Iguodala, you know, from the Warriors.
right.
And that's kind of what we're looking at here.
Yeah, you know, that's like, a good comp. Yeah, but getting them, like, you know, in another year or two. And it's just like, all right, I mean, it's fine. Like, it probably will be pretty good, right?
Helpful,
like,
yeah.
Like, right. All right, like, it's weird, but all right.
Sure. So, yeah, and Mel Daniels, you know, he'd been a, you know, again, the Pacers, they won three championships. They, you know, they've been to a bunch of finals. You know, Mel Daniels had twice been an MVP. You know, Freddie Lewis, one of the better guards in the league, three-time All-Star. Roger Brown, you know, one of the great forward, you know, three-time All-ABA, you know, four-time All-Star, you know. But, you know, these guys, you know, they were in their 30s, early 30s, but that was, you know, old for a professional athlete at the time, older than it might seem today. And, yeah, they finished only 27-57, had a negative 4.9 SRS, which was ninth in the league. You know, Brown and Lewis actually only lasted a handful of games before moving on to other teams. Daniels did last the year, although he battled injuries. And, you know, all three are pretty much near the end of their careers, as we said, although Lewis did play a key role. He ended up on the St. Louis Spirits, and they had a key role in their huge upset of the Nets later on in the 75 playoffs, which we'll get into a little bit here. Yeah, because when Daniels, he got hurt after slipping in the bathtub. I think he was recovering from an injury when that happened, so he was hurt for longer. Memphis needed a center. They traded for Tom Owens, who actually ended up probably being the Sound's best player. Soon after, you know, Brown was traded to the Utah Stars. He ended up back with the Pacers in a much reduced role, though he did help them make the finals that year as an underdog. And then Daniels, you know, he was solid after he came back from the injury, you know, averaged 9.8 points, 9.0 rebounds, 16.1 PBR, but clearly, you know, he'd fallen off from no longer a MVP, no longer really even an All-Star. But so bringing those guys in, and I don't think anyone expected them to be, you know, any of them to, you'll be like All-Stars still, you know, as great as they were. They clearly all had fallen off a little bit, but I think all three of those outcomes were about as bad as you could have expected, you know, having those guys come in.
Yeah. It's a weird, like you said, it's a tough one because it is still a team that was pretty good, but yeah, the expectations were probably higher than I think it's very safe to say the expectations were way higher than what they got as a result.
Sure.
So.
Sure. Yeah. And yeah, there's a great article on the Memphis Sounds at rememberTheABA.com, which I recommend. A lot of good details there. But yes, I mean, Mike Storin, it felt like, yeah, he could turn around the Memphis franchise, really make it viable. And they were looking toward a merger at this point too, you know, so he thought, you know, there was some thought about like, hey, we can, you know, eventually we're going to merge with the NBA probably, you know, let's make Memphis a team that can be part of that merger. You know, Storin found several local investors for the team, including Isaac Hayes and Al Wilson of Stax Records, you know, investor from Holiday Inn, you know, key local businessmen. And then in July of that year, surprised pretty much everybody by resigning as ABA commissioner, stepping in to run the team himself. Kind of an interesting thing to do, but yeah, they brought in.
That'd be awesome. Imagine,
yeah, right. Yeah,
imagine in your Orlando Magic scenario.
Adam Silver's
like, all right, you know what? I got to take over this Orlando Magic franchise and get it back on track. It's like, what? Yeah. What are you doing? Why are you doing this?
I love the Magic so much. I really believe in the Magic. I just really want them to succeed. So yeah. So
you know, just the stoic Adam Silver while today, hey, right. I am announcing my resignation as commissioner, and I am accepting an offer as the general manager of the Orlando Man. What? Why are you doing this? You don't have to do this. Make right. Wouldn't you make more money? Isn't it a lot easier and you're making more money? But I don't know. My man loves the my man loved the Memphis Sounds, and hopefully Adam Silver one day loves the Orlando Magic enough to
And they had a lot, you know, they brought in a lot of ABA veterans, you know, besides the top three, you know, George Carter, Rick Mount, who played pretty well there. The only local, the only past player, the Tams player they kept was Larry Finch, who was, you know, basically he was a Memphis State guy. So they kind of wanted a local guy other than that. But they had a lot of experience on their team. And they had Joe Mullaney, who was a, you know, respected ABA and NBA coach. He brought in, you know, they thought they were, things were going to go well, but unfortunately, the Sounds, they lost 9 of their first 10 games, pretty much killing the buzz in the city for the new team. And despite winning only 27 games, they did make a strong late run. They made the playoffs. They managed to get one win against the eventual champion, Kentucky Colonels. Could not pull off the miracle. Really interesting thing, though. They beat the Nets. I'm not sure if it was the final game. It was near the end of the season, which prevented the Nets from winning the division title. The Nets lost a tiebreaker to the Colonels and then ended up having to face the Spirits instead of having to face the Sounds. And then the Nets were ended up being upset by the Spirits, you know, who had, you know, of course, Marvin Barnes, who had Fray Lewis, as we talked about. You know, that was one of the bigger upsets in ABA history, but they could have avoided that by beating the Sounds here. And then they would have faced the Sounds in the playoffs, where they more likely would have won. And now maybe they would have lost to the, you know, whoever they face the next round, but interesting little dynamic there that I thought was kind of cool. Mm-hmm. So more from rememberTheABA.com, you know, the basically like, the Sounds, it turned out Memphis wasn't super enthusiastic about the Sounds. Obviously the late start, or the slow start didn't help. They did get attendance up later as they started to play better, but long-term it just, you know, wasn't going to go well. The team's lease with Mid-South Coliseum, you know, they didn't, you know, wasn't going well. The league started paying some of the bills to keep the team alive.
Mid-South Wrestling definitely outdrawing them for sure.
Right? Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
Like, no doubt.
Yeah, honestly, maybe they should have just brought Jerry Lawler in.
I was going to say, yeah.
You know? Yeah, yeah. I mean, Jerry Lawler, he could probably, you know, get you a few rebounds there.
They still, the Memphis Grizzlies still bring out Lawler every so often. Sure. They have those wrestling days, and they're amazing. They sell out, and Lawler puts somebody through a table, and everybody goes nuts. Yeah. I mean, he's the king of Memphis, man. Like,
That's they should know. Well, anyway, the new ABA commissioner gave the city, you know, a strict deadline of June 1975 to sell 4,000 season tickets and find new investor and get a more favorable lease. And hey, none of that happened. So they ended up being sold. It might happen. Yeah. August 1975, the Sounds were sold to some businessmen in Baltimore. And hey, they had a bizarre thing where the Baltimore investors were like way worse, and the Baltimore Claws ended up never playing a regular season game, and the franchise just completely died. So not a good end for things in Memphis, but hey, the things are good in Memphis now basketball wise. So we'll
as of this recording, things are going pretty well. So
right.
By the time you listen to this in 5 years,
Maybe they'll, maybe the Orlando Magic will be good by
That's true. Yeah. Like, with Adam Silver at the helm and Draymond Green and Klay Thompson leading the charge. Yeah. More Orlando Magic.
Orlando Magic Dynasty. They'll be like, the Magic were bad? What?
Jonathan Isaac wasn't the best player in the league at a point? Like, what are you talking about?
Exactly.
What a bizarre timeline. I hope that, I don't know if I want that.
We'll see. Not really. Yeah. Who knows?
Anyway. All right. Next one here, the 2013 Los Angeles Lakers. This is going to be fun, Lakers.
It's going to be super fun.
It was not fun at all, ever.
No, not fun. Yeah.
I was trying to remember if we were doing shows by then. We actually started, I believe, in August of 2014. So we would have been a year after this occurred. So, yeah,
almost 8 years.
Yeah. Jeez. God.
All right. But, I know.
That's a long time, man. Right. That's awesome.
I know. Yeah.
But, all right. So they add Dwight Howard and Steve Nash. And this was one of those, like, oh my God, the Lakers, what the hell? How did they pull this off? How did they do this? How did the Lakers once again get, like, the best big man in the league? They've done this. They did it with Wilt. They did it with Kareem. They did it with Shaq. And now they're doing it again with Dwight Howard. This is not fair. The league is rigged. All of this is awful. This is coming on the heels of, like, the Chris Paul thing where the league was like, no, 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 you can't get Chris Paul. Like, this isn't going to, like, you can't do that. Like, it was a ridiculous. And then this one, they were like, ah, we can't stop you from getting two great players. So I remember at the time, people were like, wait, why you stopped the Paul deal, but not this one? That's the level we were at here with Dwight Howard and Steve Nash. It seems unbelievable. It seems impossible, but I assure you that it was like, oh my God, the NBA is rigged. The Lakers, just people going nuts about this stuff. The subhead of that Sports Illustrated cover, the Now This Is Going to Be Fun, that showed Steve Nash and Dwight Howard, said one new king of the West. The New York Times called them one of the most talented lineups in NBA history. They acquired two-time MVP Steve Nash on July 11th for first-round picks in 2013 and 2015 and second-round picks in 2013 and 2014. Nash was slowing down at this point as he was entering his late 30s, but he was still an all-star and still pretty damn good. His final year in Phoenix, he averaged 12.5 points per game, 10.7 assists per game. I put rebounds per game there. I do not believe that
Steve Nash got
a double-double in points and rebounds. I believe that assists. Yeah. Then shot a career high at 53.2% from the field. He wasn't MVP Nash, but he was still pretty damn good. Here's the ESPN quote here. It says, in an unforeseen twist that could thrust the Los Angeles Lakers straight back into title contention, two-time NBA MVP Steve Nash has successfully negotiated a sign-and-trade deal from the Phoenix Suns to the Lakers that will team him up with Kobe Bryant. And sources also say that Nash is trying to convince longtime teammate Grant Hill, one of his closest friends in the game, to also join him in the Lakers. That does not happen, though. August 10th. Not just Steve Nash. Now they acquire three-time Defensive Player of the Year Dwight Howard, Earl Clark, and Chris Duhon.
Yeah, so Clark and Duhon. You can't forget about that. Yeah,
yeah. The real X factor in that whole deal is Earl Clark. Yeah. And this is a massive, massive, insane, stupid trade. It's a four-team multiplayer trade. It is the Lakers are going to send All-Star center Andrew Bynum to the Philadelphia 76ers, which I assume went well, and I'm not going to look it up. I'll just assume that Bynum on the Sixers was great, so we'll go with that. Yeah. Who will also receive shooting guard Jason Richardson from the Magic. So the Sixers are getting Bynum and Jason Richardson. The Sixers are going to send Andre Iguodala to the Denver Nuggets. The Magic, your Orlando Magic, are going to receive Aaron Aflalo, Al Harrington, Nikola Vucevic, Mo Harkless, Josh McRoberts, Krishna Iyengar, and a first-round pick from either the Nuggets or the New York Knicks in 2014, a protected first-round pick from the Sixers, a protected first-round pick from the Lakers, second-round pick from the Nuggets, and a conditional second-rounder from the Lakers in 2015. So that's a hell of a pickup for... I mean, honestly, Orlando, that was a good pickup. I mean, Nikola Vucevic, who ended up being a pretty good player for them for many years, Aflalo, who did a lot of stuff with their... Mo Harkless did a bunch of stuff. I mean, that's a pretty good haul. It's just, it's the Orlando Magic, so of course they made it awful and not fun at all, but that probably should have worked better than it did, but again, it is the Orlando Magic, so of course it didn't. Kobe Bryant via a Facebook post, because he was playing in the London Olympics at the time, and nobody was using Twitter at this time, even if Twitter was around, which much simpler time in our world when Twitter didn't exist, and Facebook was just a little, it was fine, it wasn't great, but it was okay. It wasn't just filled with your aunt posting racist stuff all the time, you know?
Right.
Your aunt didn't know about it. She didn't have it, so.
She didn't
have it. She just said racist stuff at Thanksgiving instead of on Facebook, so. But anyway, says, well, it looks like Superman has found a home. The Lakers have landed a piece that will hopefully carry the franchise long after I'm gone. I've spoken to Dwight Howard, and we are locked and loaded to hopefully bring back the title. Did that conversation actually ever happen? I'm guessing no, right?
I've spoken to...
At no point were Dwight and Kobe locked and loaded, right?
I don't think... Hopefully the words locked and loaded were not used there. I don't know. Trying to imagine a conversation between
Dwight's just like eating gummy bears or whatever. Like Kobe's like, are you ready to get to work? And Dwight's like making fart noises and eating gummy bears.
I'm guessing Kobe didn't feel good about that conversation after it.
But anyway, Howard was recovering from off-season back surgery. Not great when you're a big man that relies on athleticism and speed and strength and all that sort of stuff, which had some people worried. Also, he's a free agent after the season, and even the ESPN breakdown of the trade mentioned how he was not ready to sign with Los Angeles just yet. Los Angeles, they signed him and basically were ready to say, hey, Dwight, here you go. Here's a big-time contract. Let's get this locked up and locked and loaded. And Dwight was like, hold on a minute. So this is from the ESPN article. It says, one source briefed on Howard's plans told ESPN.com's Mark Stein that the All-Star Center will indeed stand firm on his intent to play out the 2013 season without extending his contract so he can become a free agent on July 1st, 2013. Going that route will enable Howard to decide how comfortable he is in Los Angeles before deciding whether to re-sign with the Lakers or join the Dallas Mavericks, who have the requisite salary cap space to sign Howard and who remain one of his preferred destinations from his original list of three teams, which is the Nets, Lakers, and the Mavericks. So,
So not to interrupt, but there was, if I'm recalling correctly, there was the, like, Dwight Howard was extremely close to being traded to the Nets. And I think there was an issue with Brooke Lopez that ended up being reversed, but like,
it was
like going to happen. Yeah. I just recalled that now. So,
yeah, I forget what, I think you're right. It was the Brooke. Well,
I'll look it up while you go through.
Yeah. See, cause I remember for a fact that had to, but I think whatever happened was eventually they just decided, you know what, we'll be happier with Brooke Lopez instead. But, we'll touch on that in a bit because it actually relates to a team we're going to talk about later. But things go bad almost immediately. So head coach Mike Brown decided that the Lakers, he's got this new Lakers team, and he goes, you know what we need to do? We need to run the Princeton offense for some reason. And they did need to run the Princeton offense because they went 0-8 in the preseason. It's the preseason. It doesn't really matter. Then they start 1-4. And then the Lakers say, all right, Brown, you got to go. This is right. You got to hit the bricks here. And they bring in Mike D'Antoni, who... yes, he's related to Nash or whatever, but I mean, a Mike D'Antoni team coaching Kobe and Dwight Howard, is that going to work? And no, not really, because they limped through the first month of the season with their worst start since 1994. The Lakers are in danger of straight up missing the playoffs for the first time since 2005 before finally clinching a spot on the final day of the regular season. There was extra turmoil throughout the year as well. Longtime owner Jerry Buss died in February. And it really took a physical toll for the team, you know, this year, just in general. I mean, a lot of guys had probably their biggest injury issues ever. Kobe Bryant has a great year overall. He scores 27.3 points per game, 5.6 rebounds per game, 6.0 assists per game. Plays in 48 games. However, the last game he played that year, he tore his Achilles. So at age 34, this is a huge injury for Kobe. And really, Kobe was never the same after this injury. And Dwight Howard had been an absolute monster for the Orlando Magic over the last few years. And let's not let, there's a lot of this erasure of like how great Dwight Howard was. Dwight Howard was great for many, many years. You have people that like when they're like, hey, Dwight Howard in the Hall of Fame, they're like, I don't know. No, get out of here. He was really good. Yes, he's been in the pain in the ass for the last decade, but he was really, 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 really good with the Orlando. So show some respect for him. So anyway, something was off though from the day one with the Lakers. He played in 46 games. But is scoring 17.1 points per game, with the lowest since his third year in the league. He averaged an NBA leading, 12.4 rebounds per game. But even that was down from like the 13 to 14 that he was averaging during his peak Orlando year. So he is clearly off. Something's a little wrong there. And Steve Nash, though, unfortunately, the least fun of this entire crew. His body just completely started betraying him this year. And he ends the year, 12.4 points per game, 6.7 assists per game. Not terrible. But it's not Steve Nash, and he plays in only 50 games, and he appeared to be in immense pain pretty much any time he played. This is when he couldn't even sit on the bench. He had to lay down. I mean, it was getting awful. His back was getting shot. His body was just really, really kind of abandoning himself. But anyway, San Antonio Spurs in the first round, the Lakers beyond battered at this point without Kobe Bryant, with just Dwight Howard and just Steve Nash, or just the kind of the corpse of Steve Nash, easily slept in four games. And they were... they lost game four, 103-82. Howard, who had a decent playoff run, though, fell apart in the final game. He was ejected with a couple minutes left in the game after receiving his second technical foul. Paul Gasol, who was on the team, we didn't mention him before. He gets a standing ovation when he leaves the game, as everybody kind of assumes that's the end of the run for Paul Gasol in Lakers. And this was the Lakers' first-round exit since 2007 and their first opening round sweep since 1967. They don't get swept very often, especially not in the opening round. So that is it for the Lakers. An absolute disaster. And the Kobe-Dwight relationship does not go very well. So at the beginning of the year, Dwight said of Bryant's tough love approach, so I'll take all the heat that he's going to give me, because I know at the end of the day, that's going to make me a better player and a better person, and it's going to make this team better. Did not quite work out that way. Steve Nash would say after the season, everybody could see the relationship between Bryant and Howard was going to be tough from the very start. So despite all this, despite all the turmoil, the Lakers still want to offer Dwight Howard a max contract of 5 years and $118 million. They traded Bynum for him. They traded a bunch of stuff for him. They still wanted to get him. So they give him that deal. It's on the table. It's a max deal. It's the best deal he's going to be able to get. And then on July 13th, 2013, Howard shocks the NBA world by deciding not to sign with the Lakers and instead join James Harden and the Houston Rockets. He says a championship is the priority. That's the priority. Shoot, I'm betting $30 million on it. I just looked at both teams, and I felt like Houston was going in one direction. They got a lot of young players. They got a good coach in Kevin McHale. And I feel like having him as a coach, he could really help me in the post and help me develop like I want to. That was mainly the reason right there. And having the opportunity to grow with the team, a young team like the Rockets, that's the reason why I decided to leave. Now, there's some other fun what-ifs in this Dwight Howard thing. The other teams that were looking at him, Dallas Mavericks, who, of course, were interested in him for many, many years, the Atlanta Hawks, who would eventually get Dwight Howard many years later, but not the Dwight Howard. They'd get a Dwight Howard. And then one that I always find very fascinating, the Golden State Warriors. The Golden State Warriors wanted Dwight Howard in 2014. Just like, how much of history is different if, Dwight Howard's there. You know what I mean? They sign him to like a max deal. He takes up half their payroll, all this sort of stuff. Can you imagine just how much different NBA history is if Dwight Howard waltzes into Golden State and you know, does any of what, you know, we would have over the next decade happen? I don't know. It's very,
I don't think so. Yeah. Well, they don't get Iguodala, you know, now he was really important. Obviously in the era part of the dynasty. Yeah. I don't think there's any chance that happens. So it's a completely different,
wild. So the Lakers, this would be the beginning of the end of the entire, obviously, Kobe run there. They would miss the playoffs in each of the next six seasons. Jody Meeks would lead the team in win shares the next year. Jody Meeks. That's not good. Yeah. Ed Davis would do so in 2015. Davis. These are the best players on the Lakers during these final few seasons. This is bad. Steve Nash slowly ached his way into retirement. Kobe would go on his retirement tour, obviously capping off his career with the most Kobe performance possible. And Dwight Howard, ironically enough, this is the best part of all this, would never win a title with Houston, but he would win a title with the Lakers in 2020. So it would take a couple years, but he would return to the Lakers and finally win that title. So
he got there.
So I guess it was fun in the end.
Yeah.
Not really.
Yes. It was fun. Yeah, there were definitely strong rumors about, you know, Dwight Howard trades to the Nets. And even that year with the Lakers, apparently around the All-Star time, there was even like, I never got serious, but there were at least rumors about Dwight Howard maybe getting traded to the Nets for like Brook Lopez or something like that. But it never, apparently didn't come as close to happening as I had somehow thought it came close to happening. That was such a weird one. I mean, that Nash's injury just kind of like ruined any chance of them like really being great. Unfortunately, he never really came back and, you know, was a particularly effective player again. So that
there's not two worse personalities you could possibly put together.
Oh yeah, than
Dwight Howard and Kobe Bryant.
Right.
Like
yeah.
Like one man is a maniacal maniac about, you know, like getting better and training and competitiveness, and then the other one's Dwight Howard, who's just like, you know, making fart noises or whatever.
Right.
You can just imagine like the first practice and Kobe probably going to the back being like, nah, this isn't gonna work.
No, it was not good. Yes, good. So all right, next we have the 1976 Washington Bullets. The year before, 75 Bullets, they'd won 60 games, they made the NBA Finals, ended up being swept by the Golden State Warriors in one of the bigger upsets in NBA history, although like every game in that series was extremely close. So it was kind of a weird, you know, upset, but obviously disappointing playoff result. But yeah, they were a 60-win team, they were really good, you know, best SRS in the league. They brought back Coach Casey Jones, you know, their core of Wes Unseld, Elvin Hayes, Phil Chenier. They also had Mike Riordan, Jimmy Jones, you know, good role players, good scorers, and they had budding young talents like Truck Robinson, Nick Witherspoon. So their only big change for the 76 season seemed like a good one. They were getting Washington, D.C. native and six-time All-Star Dave Bing for guard Kevin Porter. So, you know, Bing was 31, little past his scoring prime, but he was still a strong performer. You know, he averaged 19 points per game and 7.7 assists per game, having recovered from a detached retina he suffered during the 72 season that hampered his eyesight. He never completely regained it, but he still played effectively even after that point. So he's still been a good player for a number of years.
Yeah, that's still a trade that you make like a thousand. I mean, you make a trade single time. I mean, Kevin Porter ended up having a great career, obviously, but you make the trade every single time to get Dave Bing at that point, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, Porter's like a good scorer, you know, put a lot of numbers in terms of assists and steals. He's a good small guard, but was not nowhere near the star that Dave Bing was. And absolutely, that's, you know, what you want to do, even at age 31. But yeah, the Bullets fell from 60 wins to 48 wins. You know, their biggest change, they went, they upped 4 points from a 91.3 defensive rating to a 95.3. They were still second in the league, but that's a big increase from year to year. So they're giving up, you know, an average of four more points per game. They went from the sixth fastest team in the league to 13th. Probably that's a direct result of losing Porter, who's known as a fast player. They also went from fourth in the NBA to 18th in field goal attempts. So they're not nearly getting as many shots up. They did go to the foul line more. They also turned the ball over more and didn't get as many steals, which I think probably has a lot to do with both those things having a lot to do with the lack of field goal attempts. You obviously, if you're turning the ball over more and you're not getting as many turnovers, you're not going to get as many shot attempts up. So, it's not, you know, doing research into this, not really clear if there was like one thing there really doesn't seem to be like one key thing. I mean, Bing himself, he played well enough. You know, he was still an All-Star that year, won the All-Star Game MVP, you know, averaged 16 points per game and 6 assists per game. His numbers, you know, were still pretty good. You know, from all accounts, there wasn't any major dissension between him and the other teammates. And every, you know, key player on the team was more or less the same. Mike Reardon slipped a little bit, but he's like your sixth best player. You know, you can kind of absorb that. Truck Robinson had a big role and did well with it. But, you know, one important thing is that, you know, of the key guys in the team, you know, Unseld, Hayes, Bing, Reardon, you know, Jones and Clem Haskins, you know, they're all like 29 or older. So they definitely had a team that was susceptible to just, you know, slipping a little bit. You have multiple guys just, you know, like 90% as good as they were the year before. That's kind of how you go from 60 wins to 48 wins. And yeah, you're still a good team. You know, they were fourth in the league in SRS. It's a little bit more of a balanced league than it had been. So that might've been part of it too. But yeah, there it's one of those things like, yeah, you know, you look into it, you kind of shrug and you're like, yeah, I don't really know why they weren't as good. They just definitely weren't.
Yeah, it's one of these weird, and this is a kind of a common theme in a lot of these. It's just like sometimes, you know, we think, hey, they're bringing together all these really, really good players and this is going to just work. But eventually, a lot of times, being able to bring together all those really good players is also like all those good players are now starting to get a little bit older. We saw it with the Lakers, you know, with Nash. It's like, yeah, it's Steve Nash, but it's, you know, it's 35-year-old Steve Nash, or, sure, you know,
yeah.
And hell, it's going to be very, very obvious in our next team that we're going to talk about, where it's just like, yeah, sometimes it's the Pippen Rockets is another great one. It's like, yeah, these guys are all legends, but yeah, they're all in their like late. I mean, the reason you can bring together a team of four legends or, you know, three or four, like, you know, consistent all-stars, Hall of Famers is because they're getting a little bit older and that's how you're able to kind of do it. And that's how these guys are, you know, have the reputations they have. So yeah, it seems like it should work more than it does work, but yeah, sometimes it's just like the wrong combination of guys, or guys are just a little tired, or guys are just a little old or whatever. And it just kind of, yeah, but this is a weird one too, because it's just like, you don't really, it's like, yeah, this should have probably worked pretty well. And it just didn't.
Yeah, and you know, maybe they played a little bit outside of themselves in 75, and they kind went back to where they kind of should have been in 76. You know, even though, again, the numbers for everybody, you know, no one really slips dramatically. You know, everyone kind of delivers about the same as they did the year before. But yeah, they're definitely
To be fair to this team too, I mean, they're two like insane, miraculous like moments away from being, you know, a really, you know, like a not a dynasty, but like, you know, a team that you know, they're the biggest upset in NBA, you know, history, NBA Finals history, and like the miracle at Richfield away from being like, you know, a dominant 2-year team or whatever. So
right, yeah, and they lost this was like the first time in 6 years they didn't win the division title. You know, the Cavs won. I think the Cavs were like one game better than the Bullets, and then in the playoffs, the Cavs win. You know, the dramatic series, Dick Snyder's dramatic, you know, game-winning shot in 76 to lose in Cleveland, you know, in the first round. And Casey Jones is casualty of that. He gets fired from the team. I think this was his third year as the coach. You know, and the expectation, there's a New York Times article about it. You know, expectation is like, yeah, their personnel is regarded as the best in the league. You know, that one quote from Wes Unseld is like, it took time for Bing and his new teammates to gel. Interesting. He's like speaking the third person there, almost like he's not one of the new teammates, even though he is.
Which isn't good. I guess that doesn't bode well either.
Right, right. So yeah, it's not my fault. No, I don't know. But coach can't do much about that. Casey is a man. He treated us like that. Maybe that was the mistake, expecting everyone to act like a professional. As individuals, we just couldn't put everything together as a team. But So after this, they bring in Dick Motta as the coach. Even though he was good in 76 and 77, he definitely fell off and, you know, left for the Celtics to finish his career there at one more season. So he was pretty much done. But, you know, 77, they pretty much have the same record. They do make the second round of the playoffs, but, you know, aren't any, you know, they'll perform significantly better. In fact, they're worse SRS wise in the regular season. They finished 10th in SRS. So it seems like they're slipping. But, you know, before 78, they end up adding Bob Dandridge. And over those couple of years, they do end up, you know, having a pretty, they get a younger supporting cast, you know, to complement Hayes and Unseld. They get Tom Henderson, Mitch Kupchak, Kevin Grevey gets a bigger role. You know, Larry Wright, Charles Johnson, Greg Ballard, all, you know, kind of key guys in 78 and 79 when they win the title in 78, as, you know, kind of a surprise considering they, you know, they only won 44 games in the regular season. And then, you know, make the finals in 79, losing to the Sonics. So, you know, they end up kind of retooling. You know, Motta ends up being, you know, looks like the right coach for that team, obviously. But, yeah, but, you know, Casey Jones probably got a – he got done dirty a little bit through in that situation.
For sure. All right. Let's get to now the 2014 Nets. And by time, we were doing a show in August of 2014. So I think at this point we already knew this was a disaster. But right. I am going to go on record that even when this deal happened, I was like, I don't think this is going to work. This is – where were you at with this, the 2013-2014
Nets? I thought short – like, I thought they would be good that year. I'm certainly better than they were. Like, and I thought they were like a championship contender for one team. Like most everybody else, I thought like, oh wow, this is like way too much to give up to get, you know, old Kevin Garnett, old Paul Pierce, and, you know, really old Jason Terry. But like, I still thought like, okay, well, this year they should probably be, because, you know, those Celtics teams had fought the Heat's so tough and they come close to beating them. It's like, yeah, you have those key guys, you know, you've got Darren Williams, you got Joe Johnson. Like, yeah, that short-term, that makes sense. It's way too much to give up, but short-term, I was more optimistic, I guess, than you were at the time.
Yeah. I was just, I don't know. I was just kind of not like, I was just like, those guys are getting kind of old or whatever, but right. You know, but you're right. My expectations were probably not, they're, you know, they're not going to waltz into the finals, but like, I still, yeah, probably thought that they'd be competitive.
Shot at it. Yeah, yeah, right. A
decent shot at it, and that did not quite happen. So the 2014 Nets, they add Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, and Jason Terry. It's the second year of the Nets in Brooklyn, and they are ready to kick this rebrand into overdrive. And the first year in Brooklyn went relatively well. The Nets finished with a 49-33 record. That was their first winning season since 2006. And I saw this little nugget, too, which blew my mind, but is absolutely true. Excluding their ABA years, this was the second best year, tied for the second best year in franchise history, and the first time that the Nets ever in their NBA history, not ABA, NBA history, had a winning record on the road. And I was like, that's impossible. They went to back-to-back NBA finals. Yeah, so they won 52 games in the first Jason Kidd year, when he, obviously he was a player, not a coach, and then 49 the second. So that second year tied, you know, this year, or the first year in Brooklyn as the best record ever, which is unbelievable considering how long they've been around. But even more unbelievably, they didn't have a winning record on the road in either of those years. The 52 win year, they were 19-22 on the road. And then in 2003, when they won 49 games, they were 16-25 on the road.
That's so weird. Like,
field advantage of the Meadowlands Arena.
You know? Right. It's not like they're in Denver. Like, Denver, you get that.
Right. There's no, there's nothing. Yeah. It's a
right
horrible arena built on a swamp. Like, there is.
It's not. Yeah. It's not like travel's like a huge thing.
The airport's like right next to the arena.
Right.
It couldn't be any easier there. I guess the allure of New York City was so much that I don't know, but you're not in it, you know, like, I mean, the Knicks didn't have this, the Knicks weren't, like, you know what I mean, like, man, it's so wild. Yeah, I was like, that's an impot, that's not true, that's these people are forgetting all right,
crazy.
But anyway, back to 2014, former Nets star, the aforementioned Jason Kidd, was hired as head coach. And then on July 12th, 2013, the Nets made the biggest trade in their franchise's history, acquiring Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, and Jason Terry from the Boston Celtics. Nets general manager Billy King says, honestly, did I think we could pull off something like this? No. But Celtics GM Danny Ainge and I just kept working at it and got to the point where we were both comfortable. Can you imagine that? Danny Ainge making a deal. Actually, getting to the table, and making a deal instead of just saying he was going to make a deal, and then darn it, he just couldn't make it. So
well, he got a lot of draft picks, so
but he got this one done. So
yeah, he did. Yeah. All right.
Mikhail Prokhorov. Remember Mikhail Prokhorov?
Oh, I do. Yes.
He says, today the basketball gods smiled on the Nets. With the arrival of Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce, we have achieved a great balance on our roster between veteran stars and young talents. This team will be dazzling to watch and tough to compete against. So. Of course, this wasn't peak Garnett and Pierce. Garnett at this time was 37. Pierce was 35. But Billy King says here, I hope people keep questioning KG and Paul Pierce's age because I know the type of Warriors they are. The workload will not be as much as it's been in the past because of their teammates, but I enjoy the fact that people keep questioning Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce. I know that they'll come out and prove them wrong, so I'm not concerned about that at all. Should have been concerned a little bit. But fun fact, there was an initial trade here that Garnett vetoed because the first deal did not include Jason Terry. And he basically was like, nah, really, man, I don't want Terry on that rebuilding team. I want him to come along with us. So he insisted that Terry go along with them, and he got it done. So I don't know what they had to add to get Jason Terry in there, but who knows? So in the end, the Celtics return package here, which they would receive Gerald Wallace, Marshawn Brooks, and Chris Humphries. They would also get Keith Bogans, Chris Joseph, and first-round draft picks in 2014, 2016, and 2018, as well as the rights to swap first-round picks with the Nets in 2017. So when it all finished, here is the entire haul. Just think of this. This haul is insane, and it could have even been even that much more insane as well. They got Keith Bogans, arguably the biggest.
Sure, yeah, you got to get Bogans. Yeah.
Right, I mean, that changed the whole dynamic of the entire team. Sure, yeah, Marshawn Brooks, not as much as Keith Bogans, but solid nonetheless.
Yeah.
Chris Humphries, Chris Joseph, Gerald Wallace. A 2014 first-round pick, that was just James Young. Yeah, that's all right.
Yeah.
2016, Jalen Brown, who obviously still an important piece of the Boston Celtics. Yeah. A 2017 first-round draft pick, which they selected Markelle Fultz, but obviously then flipped Markelle Fultz to the Sixers for Jason Tatum. So they got Jalen Brown and Jason Tatum in this.
Yeah.
A 2018 first round pick, they got Colin Sexton, or Colin Sexton was later selected. This was moved in the Kyrie Irving trade. So an interesting fact there, wrinkle that, you know, if they never make that Kyrie Irving trade, they have, you know, someone like that. I mean, Colin Sexton's not that great, but hell, if Kyrie stays, like, that's an even bigger, you know, whatever. Sure. And then they got the 2017 number one overall pick from Brooklyn as a result of that pick swap to get to the Markelle Fultz thing. So essentially, even with like the Kyrie thing being worth nothing at that point, the 2018 pick, and even with, you know, James Young in 2014 and none of those players really mattering, in one deal, they got Jalen Brown and Jason Tatum, who are, you know, key building blocks of their entire team. Sure. And it could have been even more ridiculous if the Kyrie trade had worked out and not been, you know, a complete disaster.
Sure.
Nuts. It was absolutely nuts. So.
Absolutely, yeah.
No. But it was all worth it for the Nets because they go into the season with the highest payroll in the NBA and the expectations that Pierce, Garnett, and Terry are going to join the solid core of Brook Lopez, Deron Williams, and Joe Johnson. And people, don't forget, at this time in 2014, there was legit conversations about Deron Williams and Chris Paul, and you were not nuts if you thought that Deron Williams was better than Chris Paul.
Well, I think in 2014 maybe, but like 2011.
Yeah. But 2014, you're kind of being stupid with that. Right. It's probably Chris Paul, but... Yeah. I guess you could kind of, but now, like a decade later, it just seems absolutely absurd to people that, like, you have to say, no. There was legit a time where people were like, yeah, Chris Paul's good, but I don't know. I think Deron Williams
is good. Yeah.
That was a decade ago, and Chris Paul's still really, really good, and Deron Williams has been retired for a decade now.
Yeah. Like,
it's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. So things went south fast for this team. They were 5-12 after the first month of the season, 24-27 by the All-Star break. They finally limp into the playoffs at 44-38. Things weren't bad, they just weren't that good. Bad defensive rating, bad net rating, one of the worst paces in the league. And what's weird, too, even attendance at the Barclays Center wasn't exactly gangbusters. They had this idea that, oh, man, this is going to put Brooklyn on the map, and it just really didn't. They finished 17th out of 30 in attendance. Brook Lopez started the year great, but fractured his foot in December, and he would miss the rest of the season. Deron Williams, his numbers fell a lot from the prior year as he scored just 14.3 points per game, the lowest since his rookie year. Like we're saying, now this is where you're starting to be like, I don't know. What do we got here with this Deron Williams guy? This would really be the beginning of the end for him as well. Your man, ISO Joe Johnson, was solid as usual, made the All-Star game again after a one-year absence. Cool. His scoring did drop slightly, but he played in 49 games, was solid, kind of calming factor around the whole turmoil as he's just Joe Johnson. He's just kind of hard hat, lunch pail, goes to work, does his thing, you know.
Yeah.
And this is when we should also mention as well that this was that random year when they signed Andre Kirilenko for, like, league minimum, and everyone's like, So you're telling me that this Russian owner signed Andrei Kirilenko, who played in Russian national leagues, for a league minimum. Nobody wanted to pay him anymore, and everybody was kind of like, that's kind of weird. But it didn't matter, because he fell off a cliff. He scored only 5 points per game, and he'd be out of the league after just 7 games the next season. But that was a thing. Like, there was people really kind of curious how the hell they got Andrei Kirilenko there. But it didn't matter, because it ended up not working out very well at all. And then what about the Boston guys? Paul Pierce, his scoring fell from 18.6 points per game in Boston the prior year to 13.5 with Brooklyn. He was fine, but he was 36 and starting to slow down. Kevin Garnett, oh man, did things fall apart for Kevin Garnett. He was 37, but he was coming off an all-star season still. Nobody could have expected his scoring to fall from 14.8 points per game to 6.5. 6.5 points per game. He did still grab 6.6 rebounds per game, but this is Kevin Garnett. His shooting also fell to 44%. So yeah, he probably the biggest guy that just, it just was like, oh yeah, no, I'm not that good anymore. Sorry. Tried. He yelled a lot still, but it was done. Yeah, the bloom was off the rose, unfortunately. So that, him more than almost anybody was just like, the, oh boy, I don't know if this is going to work. Yeah. And Jason Terry didn't even last the season. This is the best part about this whole thing, is they're like, nah, man, nah, we can't let Jason Terry, like, he's got to be with us. The deal can't happen unless Jason Terry's with us. Like, you know, he can't be on a rebuilding bad team or whatever. We're not going to let it happen. They trade him to the Sacramento Kings for Marcus Thornton. Jason Terry goes, I'm not playing in Sacramento. He never does play in Sacramento. He eventually would sign with Houston later, and then he would have a couple years with Milwaukee and stuff, but this is pretty much the end of Jason Terry.
He hung around for a while.
He did hang around for like four or five more years, but this was the end of him being like starter, six-man Jason the Jet, and then he just became like cagey veteran Jason Terry after this, is fine.
Right.
But
sure.
What's weird, though, is I tried to dig for it. There's just not a whole lot of drama involved with this team. Everybody kind of knew the score, and we're just like, yeah, we're just kind of bad, not that good. Kevin Garnett during the season said, when we lose, it's like this. It's a complete lack of focus. There's no way we should be losing by 40 to any NBA team with the guys we got. I've got to say, it's a complete lack of focus. That's all I have to say. We just didn't show up. They weren't that good. They would make the playoffs and they'd win a first-round series against Toronto, but then they'd get pretty handed by the defending champion Miami Heat in the second round. And then it just kind of all falls apart. Pierce is like, I'm not going to stick around. I'm going to go join the Wizards. So he joins the Wizards. Garnett stays for the next year, but he's traded in February back to Minnesota. Jason Terry, as we mentioned, is gone. So basically, everybody's gone. Like, 2 years in, like, everybody is gone. The Nets finished 38-44. They were able to squeak into the playoffs as an 8 seed, and then that would be their last playoff appearance until 2019. And then it just kind of ended. So it was a big to-do. They trade a bunch of shit. They trade a bunch of guys. They trade a bunch of draft picks. They basically set the Boston Celtics up for another decade. And then, like, a year later, it was just kind of all gone. And there's not a whole lot of, like, he said, she said, oh, this is why. It was just like, yeah, we were kind of old and we were just kind of bad. So I don't know.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest drama was involved Jason Kidd, because, like, at the beginning of the year, near the early part of the season, when they got off to that bad start, he demoted, you know, like, Lawrence Frank, like, his former coach, like, you know, who he brought in as an assistant. Like, there was that weirdness about, I'm gonna blame him on Lawrence Frank. And then after the season, you know, he ends up, you know, going to the Bucks. You know, like, he ends up leaving the team entirely and going to the Bucks. And then, you know, Lionel Hollins is their coach the next season. But yeah, like, in the season there, it was more, I kind of forgot how much. I mean, it was really Deron Williams and Garnett. Those are the two guys who really just kind of, like, fell off entirely. You know, and Garnett, I don't think, is quite as particularly. And he only played 54 games that year, too. You know, like, I forget if there's a specific injury that he had, or if he just, you know, was banged up here and there.
Yeah,
but,
I think it was just little nagging stuff. And this, this is when it just kind of overnight was just like, oh yeah, I'm old. I've been playing in the league for, you know, 15 years, playing really hard, long playoff runs. Like, it all just kind of came to a head here. He's 37. Right. Like, that's pretty normal.
You know? You would expect him to be a little better, I guess. But yeah, obviously the injuries and just, and a little bit of reduced role and everything. Yeah. I mean, I think him and Deron Williams were, like, kind of the key ones that kind of fell off there. Yeah. And the Celtics actually had a better regular season and deeper playoff run than the Nets did in the 2015 season. So, like, the Celtics weren't even bad for that long, you know? So, kind of funny how that ended up working out. All right, we got one more. Two straight years of the New York Knicks, 1976, 1977. Again, I don't know if either of these teams were a realistic title threat, but they were definitely big stars, expected to shake things up, expected to make the team better. You know, interesting transition between eras and definitely worth talking about. So 76 Knicks, you know, they added Spencer Haywood. And Spencer Haywood at that point had been awesome. Like, he was only 26. He'd been an ABA MVP. He was 5 times all league and 3 times in the first team. He'd averaged 26 points per game, 13.6 rebounds with a 21.9 PER. Absolutely star. There were some red flags. You know, his relationship had deteriorated with Coach Bill Russell and the Sonics. You know, he wasn't definitely, he was more of a, you know, offensive minded guy. Although, you know, he actually played fairly well, you know, some defense with Seattle. You know, Seattle had never been like, you know, particularly good team. They made the playoffs a little bit, but they were kind of middling. So, you know, there were some reasons to think like, oh, maybe he's not quite as great as he was. But, and the Knicks, you know, they were 40 and 42 the prior year. You know, they'd lost Willis Reed. They'd lost Jerry Lucas. They'd lost Dave DeBuscher, you know, after the 74 season. So, but they still had Walt Frazier. They still had Roman Rowe. They still had Bill Bradley from the title year. So, you know, you definitely think that, yeah, maybe, you know, this is going to turn them around, at least make them like a strong playoff team. But, you know, after the trade, which happens in October 75, Red Holzman, Knicks coach, said, hey, Spencer has to be considered a superstar of the game. The fact that he has been around so long and is still so young and has accomplished so much is a hell of a positive note. It'll make us a lot stronger. We're getting a hell of a runner, shooter, and rebounder. So, interesting how he arrived. There's a great New York Daily News article that kind of recaps some of it, you know, Knicks at all. There was also had been talk that they were going to try to get Will Chamberlain at the time. That kind of fell through. So, you know, when it happens with Haywood, you know, Walt Frazier says, yeah, it's even better than acquiring Will Chamberlain. That's how good this is. And then Haywood, when asked in his introductory press conference about fans considering a savior, Haywood responded, then I'll save. There you go. Apparently it made, you know, it ticked off his teammates a little bit. Phil Jackson, of course, you know, who's, you know, Phil Jackson is, you know, sourpuss. Phil Jackson is confirmed. Haywood, you know, Phil Jackson. Yeah. We really miss your
Zen
5
master.
Points, your 5
yeah, no, yeah. No, man. He's Zen. It's all about, you know, inner peace and all that sort of stuff.
How dare you disrespect, you know, Phil Jackson and his 6 points per game and 4 rebounds per game, you know, he's like, yeah, it's like Phil even confronted Haywood about asking how 2-time champions can be saved by a player with 0 titles. Yeah, I guess, you know, half these guys were 2-time champions. So there you go.
But yeah, and, not because of you, though. I mean, you were right. A part of it.
Yeah, you were right. But yeah.
Chill out, man. Yeah.
So Haywood's quote later on, he's like, yeah, I was coming in as a savior, and that was the first bad turn because the Knicks had 2 championships, and I was coming in as a savior, and I'm replacing Jerry Lucas, Willis Reed, and David Buescher, and I'm one person. So that was a bit unfair. But I thought I could do it all, you know. He's like, I'm like, hey, I'm coming here to do this. So that rubbed people the wrong way, the team. If you won 2 championships and I'm talking a bit how I'm saving, that was a bad turn, you know. So, you know, he understood later that it upset people. But and this was also after, like, the offseason could have been even bigger because before they got Haywood, they reached an agreement with George McGinnis, who had been the ABA MVP, on a 6-year contract. But it was rejected by the NBA because the Sixers had held his rights after choosing him in the draft. They were even stripped of their first round pick in the 76 draft, which is the first time a team had been stripped of its pick there. So, you know, I don't know if they would have gotten Haywood had they gotten McGinnis, but still, you know, obviously McGinnis was an even better player at that point than Haywood, although would also have an early decline, although not as dramatically as Haywood's was. Yeah, but the season just, you know, it started very poorly. They, you know, they ended up starting 10 and 20. They did go on a 6-game winning streak. And then later on in January, they had another 6-game winning streak. So they were 24 and 23 at one point, but that was the only point in which they had a winning percentage over 500. They, it was the first time since the 66 season the team did not reach the playoffs. And, you know, one thing that Haywood did say is that, you know, he very much got into the New York partying scene with his new wife, who was the supermodel Iman, recreationally used cocaine and went out there. It sounds like it was the kind of thing where it was more like he liked to go out and have fun, but it wasn't really like addiction level problem. Until,
right.
Like,
it was the 70s in New York. I mean, let's be honest. He was not alone in enjoying himself and enjoying a little bit of
that affected. So. Yeah. That affected a lot of guys. Yeah. But then obviously things got really bad for the Lakers. Right. And he's, you know, he's putting out a hit on his coach. You know, things got deep there, but
things did get a little worse. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, it became a full blown issue. issue. And you mentioned supermodel Iman. She was married to David Bowie after Spencer Haywood, right? That's incredible. Like, can imagine, like, it's Spencer Haywood and David Bowie. Like, what a combination of people to be married to. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Like, have they ever had imagine a Spencer Haywood, David Bowie conversation. Like, what does that go like?
I don't know. That's a good question.
They've met at some point, right? They had
I don't know. I don't know if they had kids or anything, if that would have been involved, but that would have been interesting. Yeah. 3.5 years with the Knicks, you know, Haywood averaged 17.1 points per game, 8.6 rebounds, you know, 16.3 PR. So he was productive.
Yeah,
I mean, it wasn't like terrible, but like, you know, his first season in 76, definitely his strongest before he kind of dealt with injuries and other issues, including a fit with the big star they bring in 1977, which is Bob McAdoo, who was the 1975 MVP. They also bring in Jim McMillan, who had been like part of the Lakers 69 win team, still was really good with those Braves teams. So like they give up John Gianelli and $3 million. That's like a huge trade.
Yeah,
it seems like, hey man, that's gonna be awesome. But
be fun. The New York Times
they go from 38 wins to 40 wins and McAdoo, he starts the All-Star game, you know, Monroe's an All-Star again, but yeah, they end up finishing with a 0.01 SRS. The 13th in the league. They're not really good on offense or defense. They're just, they're a very average team, unfortunately. And, you know, McAdoo, like, certainly the Knicks are not as good as is expected during this time. And, you know, we've talked a lot about McAdoo in the past and how he kind of has like a weird decline in the late 70s. But with the Knicks, he averaged 26.7 points, 12 rebounds, 3.3 assists, 1.4 blocks, and 1.3 steals in 171 games. So production-wise, he was still really strong. You know,
We did a show about that not that long ago, about how, like, because people kind of consider McAdoo in New York like a huge disappointment. It's like, no, the dude was great.
He fell off after that a lot, obviously. But at that point, production. Now, again, like, does he play defense? Does he fit well with teammates? That stuff, you know, isn't happening. You know, one illustration of that is this year, this 77 next. And they still got Walt Frazier, though Walt Frazier's obviously long in the tooth. You know, he's by the 77 season, he's 31, Monroe's 32. Kevin Garnett. No, Bill Bradley. Bill Bradley. Yes, Bill Bradley retired in 76. So that was his last season. He doesn't play in 77, but they're a little better, but they still win only 40 games. They do make the playoffs. They lose in the, oh no, I'm sorry. They do not make the playoffs in 77. They would make it in 78. They give up 68 points to Pete Maravich. Pete Maravich just destroys, you know, everyone they put in front of him, including Walt Frazier, who, you know, had hounded Maravich early on in his career. So Maravich got a little bit of individual justice there. And then, 78 season, they bring in Willis Reed as the coach. They try to get out to inspire the big man. There's a Sports Illustrated article from December of 77, but they basically say, like, hey, you know, they have Haywood, describes Haywood McAdoo as two players who through all their pro lives have had to do little more than shoot and block shots. So not a whole lot of respect for what they were doing. And it describes how Haywood is like, he's actually like, he understands like, okay, McAdoo's here. He kind of plays my spot. You know, neither one is, you know, McAdoo's tall enough to be a center, but really isn't like, the type of player who's going to be a center in the late 70s NBA. And Haywood's, you know, more better forward. So he understands that like, okay, McAdoo's going to be the scorer here. So I have to try and be a guy who's going to play defense and rebound. And he even has like this list of like 17 rules over his locker at the Madison Square Garden, just, you know, beginning like, I'm going to box out, I'm going to rebound, I'm going to play pressure defense. And then it ends with concentrate. Like, you can tell, like, at some level he wants to do it, but just like doesn't have the discipline or like the mentality, or just isn't able to like shift his game to the level where he's going to be able to do those little things and be different than, you know, he's been for like the rest of his entire career.
Yeah, it's tough. Yeah, on paper this seems like a team that should have worked, but yeah, it doesn't unfortunately.
Well, sure, worked better than it did. I mean, are they ever going to be like championship level? You know?
Yeah.
Oh,
right. No, yeah. Disappointment in the sense that maybe you thought it was going to be a little bit more fun, a little bit more exciting than it was, and kind of usher in that the new era of New York Knicks basketball, and it really did not.
And I'm sorry, Bradley did play in the 77 season, but he was in a much reduced role, playing 15 minutes per game at that point. So, Phil Jackson, was older at that point. I mean, obviously everybody was older, but, Frazier he definitely slipped, and they obviously traded him to Cleveland. Monroe, still pretty good, but, they didn't have, and there was another case where their guys kind of got older, their key guys, and they didn't have a lot of good players. I mean, Lonnie Shelton ended up, he was a good young player. Jim McMillan fell off quite a bit after that trade. I think they would have expected more out of him. So there's a lot of good reasons why they, it was a number of guys. It wasn't necessarily just one guy, but obviously McAdoo and Haywood, kind of the poster child of the idea of the team at the time of trying to buy a star and getting them to, be better, and the idea of how important team play is during that time. And kind of, I think they were, we have this obviously we're in an era, we've been in the era for kind of the last 10 years or so of, super team era of putting star players together and, kind of making a go of it. And sometimes, putting that ahead of chemistry, sometimes it works really well. Sometimes with the examples this year with the Lakers and the Nets, it hasn't worked as well. But I think, McAdoo and Haywood are kind of a cautionary tale. We're a cautionary tale of not doing that for a long time of it's obviously there's more to a team than putting stars together. But after the Haywood trade, which happens in January of 79, they basically, there's an illustration of in the first half, McAdoo, who's matched against smaller forward, takes 9 shots and made 6. In the second half, McAdoo only took 2 shots, while Haywood took 10 shots and made 4. And then after, there's a anecdote about McAdoo, deciding, he's he was in a workout, but he said he developed stomach pains and didn't want to do the workout. And then said he was upset about not being given the ball in the second half of the game. Said he was mismatched against Bingo Smith and Mike Mitchell. And he says, talking about his team, those guys are making numerous problems for themselves by not giving up the ball. It was so easy for them to see that I was involved in mismatches. So
again, the Dave Bing thing, when you're saying those guys and then you're referring to your teammates, not good.
Right. Exactly. Right. Yeah. Those guys it's not my fault. They're not giving me the ball. if they would just give me the ball, everything would be great. So yes. So, yeah. And then McAdoo, of course, would be traded, I think in the offseason after that. So,
Fun. So yeah, and obviously we were going to talk about the 2022 Nets, but I mean we've gone long. You're living it right now. You saw it in real time. Kyrie and Kevin Durant come together in an offseason, and they say, "Hey, we're going to build this thing here." They acquire James Harden, and they say, "Oh man, now we go." And then
Kyrie decides, "I'm not going to get vaccinated. I'm not going to play." So
James Harden still struggling after deciding to get fat to try to get traded, and then said, "All right, well now I'll just lose all my fat." And then they went, "Oh, wait a minute, I'm 33 now. That doesn't work the same as it did when I was 27." So let me tell you, it sucks. Yeah, getting fat it takes a lot of time to not get fat anymore.
It does. You get older. It's hard. So, it's tough.
It is quite the struggle. So you're living it. You see it right now, but maybe in episode 500 we'll cover the 2022 Nets when it's now.
Oh yeah, I'm sure
a distant thing that nobody remembers. Sure. But
that'd be a great reason. Yeah, when we're talking about that Atlanta Magic dynasty, we'll also talk about. Hey, remember when that's for good? Exactly. So
there you go. So that is that. That was fun. I like that. That was a good little show we did.
I enjoyed that one for sure. Yeah. Hopefully the listeners enjoyed it as well. Yeah, but we went a little long, but it's been a while since we've been here. So you get more of us this time. So it's all good. But everyone, of course, you can check us out over and back NBA.com. If you want to find us on social media, we are at Facebook and Twitter at over and back NBA. You can find us there. Give us comments. See if there's any other teams that you think why did you talk about these guys? Don't mention the 2004 Lakers. We've already addressed that. So don't bother with that. But any other team you think this team brought this guy or you're totally wrong about the Memphis Sounds, Jason. How dare you speak, ill of Joel Mullaney or Mike Storin. So anyway, if you got any opinions like that, feel free to share them with us. If you want to, find us on any podcast platform, want to give us a rating and review, a good one, we would prefer that. We appreciate that. Otherwise, just keep on listening. We're back again soon.